Hello, it's Scott Manley here. Starship flight number 13 finally went off today, and it had an extraordinarily surprising ending. This was the second flight of a V3 Starship, and of course, the second flight with the V3 Raptors, which unfortunately in flight number 12 had proven to be problematic. We had problems during the boost back, which resulted in the booster being damaged and crashing into the ocean, and then we had a Raptor fail during ascent. And engine reliability is essential to the recovery and reuse of these rockets. SpaceX have been rightfully cautious about putting a Starship into a proper orbit, knowing that if that engine fails to relight, it will be a giant piece of space debris which could come down anywhere on the Earth, and moreover, something that could actually survive descent and crash into the ground and cause damage. So we were really hoping that Flight 13 would actually put them in a situation where we could look at Flight 14 and say that is finally going into a proper orbit. And after today, we're in the odd situation where the Starship absolutely performed exceptionally well, but the booster had issues with landing and relighting its engines. So with that in mind, I want to rewind to July 10th, when they performed this long-duration static fire on the booster. It was almost a minute, and as I understand it, it was firing all 33 engines, and of course from this angle it looks amazing. You can see the pressure waves moving out. Yes, this thing is so loud you can actually see the sound waves it produces. So having demonstrated that the booster and all those Raptor engines are in full working order, they proceeded to prepare for the launch, which was going to be on the 16th. Which was an interesting date for me because I was supposed to be at an open source event that night, and I wasn't sure whether I was going to be able to get to it if I had to make a video response. As it happened, I didn't need to do anything because what happened was the booster lit its engines and very quickly shut down. So this was a pad abort with essentially zero time. If you pause the video at the exact right moment in the bottom left, you can see all but four of the engines are lit. And apparently they have a launch commit criteria that says they can lose no more than two engines on the stand. And while this looks pretty boring from a spectator's point of view, I'm pretty sure behind the scenes this was incredibly exciting in the wrong kind of way. As observers, we wondered why all the engines operated successfully during the test fire, and yet some of them failed during the actual launch. Over the following days, we would see everything destacked, and a number of engines were taken off the booster and replaced with new ones. But it wasn't until today that we got the lowdown from SpaceX on what actually happened. And it appears that this was a problem related to ice in the engine's turbopumps. Apparently the engines that were removed, they showed small quantities of ice, enough to perhaps mess with, say, things like spinning out turbines or opening valves, whatever. You probably don't want to have water ice in a cryogenic system, because at that point it stops being like the nice stuff you put in your drink and more like abrasive stuff that will destroy your engines. And some of you might wonder, how would ice get inside a rocket engine? And I'm going to point out that when you burn methane, you make water and you make carbon dioxide, both of which can harden into ice. So the real question is, how did those remain in the system? It's great that SpaceX were able to address this problem by swapping out engines, but if you're going to have a fully fast reusable system, you need to have these things turn around quickly. And we know that they have been dumping exhaust gas into the tanks for endogenous pressurization, and we know that there's ice in there. So I think this is something that we're going to be seeing long term that they're going to try to address, is making sure that the engines can run and rerun in rapid succession and not worry about the combustion products hardening and locking their valves in place. But regardless, let's actually talk about the flight itself.
While NASA is struggling to fund its space programs, last year big tech companies spent over $400 billion on AI infrastructure. That's more than the entire Apollo program cost when you adjust for inflation. So it's like we're running multiple moon missions every month right now, except this time we don't have anything like the moon as a clear destination. AI is already showing up in medicine, law, science, and government, and it's moving incredibly fast. The same models that were still getting basic math wrong just a couple years ago are now helping researchers understand diseases at the molecular level. Even the experts are surprised by how quickly it's advancing and how often people think that it's just being used to make cat memes. And I can totally understand that while some of you believe this technology is an inevitable part of humanity's bright future, many of you are also concerned about its impact on the world that you've grown up in. I think we all want to live in the sci-fi future where humanity prospers. The future of this stuff isn't set in stone. The decisions are being made right now that will shape things for a long time to come, and I think it's important that people get involved in steering it in the right direction. If you've been thinking you should probably understand what's going on with AI a bit better, then you're not alone. Myself, I was working on machine learning in my day job, and I found myself working hard to keep up with developments outside of my specialty. And that's where Blue Dot Impact comes in. They're a nonprofit that was built with the idea of educating people, giving them the power that they need to participate in the future. Blue Dot Impact offers completely free courses funded through philanthropy to help curious, capable people get informed about AI and find real ways to help make sure that it goes well for humanity. This isn't just a thing for software developers. AI is being used to assist doctors, lawyers, and engineers, even content creators on social media. Whatever your skills, there's an AI angle, and importantly, there's impacts that you want to anticipate. Thousands of people have already gone through these programs, and they're now working on these issues inside of places like Anthropic, Google, OpenAI, and NATO. This video is sponsored by Blue Dot Impact. Their free Future of AI course is a great 2-hour starting point for anyone. No technical background needed. Follow the link in the description for a clear, no-nonsense way to get up to speed, regardless of where you stand on AI. Their mission is to educate people on this technology, and it's right in line with my philosophy of continually learning and understanding new things. And now, back to the video.
Now, I will say that on Thursday there was a plan to launch it, but that was called off very early. For today, there was a small, like 6-7 minute delay early on, but ultimately, very early in the window, they counted down to zero. All the engines lit together, and it took off. Again, the most powerful rocket in the world, ascending under a spectacular amount of force. One interesting tidbit, by the way, was that the Thursday launch cancellation was... It was stated because the visibility was low, they wouldn't be able to keep cameras on the heat shield, and it sounds like they're very specifically using long zoom cameras to examine the heat shield and watch for debris coming off during the ascent. During the ascent is one of the more violent phases where they're punching their way through the atmosphere, and aerodynamic forces are very likely, you know, going to interact with the heat shield and potentially cause shedding of tiles. So they would like to monitor that, since the heat shield's going to be a big deal. Another interesting tidbit was those S-40 decals there on the side of the Starship. Those weren't there a week ago, so those were only added sometime between the initial launch attempt and this launch attempt. Regardless, I'm loving the new camera views here. We get, of course, some mock effects as we're heading through Max Q here, punching its way through the sound barrier. Now I want to switch to an unofficial angle. This is from NASAspaceflight.com. At about 47 seconds, there is this sort of like flame that appears to jet out, and it's not clear if it comes from an engine or if it's something falling off the rocket and getting incinerated by the exhaust. I don't think I see any evidence for it in the SpaceX feed, and it certainly doesn't show up in telemetry as an engine failing or something. So yeah, it could be something falling off, but you know, based on the color, it could also be something going fuel rich or even engine rich for a fraction of a second, but the booster does continue to keep you going. And then we cut to this new angle on the left showing the engine bay or the engines on the booster with a number of red hot parts. And a number of people also noticed this particular part seems to get much hotter, but this is also at the same time as we're having booster engine cut out. And of course, on the right, you will see the engines firing on the Starship. Now, the engine ignition sequence is different in this case, because if you remember, the booster kind of was flipped in the wrong direction, but you saw those engines light up and the vectors and the core kind of pulled together. But we didn't actually see what happened for the booster flip. Fortunately, we did get to see it from SpaceX later on. This is from the top of the booster looking downwards, and it does look like it's flipping up over the top, which is the direction you want to go. And you can see all this wonderful interaction between the plumes. Slowing it down, look down the side of the rocket, you can see the exhaust from Starship is impinging on the side of the booster, while Starship, of course, is heading off into space. Now, the booster is firing its engines, and the two exhaust plumes from both spacecraft is interacting and creating this like halo of fire in the tenuous upper atmosphere. And
I think Andrew McCarthy actually got a photo of this from the ground. And of course, everything Andrew McCarthy shoots looks absolutely fabulous. So I have to share that here. I've seen Smarter Every Day's video where they try to hit a bullet with another bullet. Well, this is what happens when you hit a flamethrower with another flamethrower. So the booster relit all its engines successfully. It performed its boost back. It intentionally left it slightly short so they wouldn't land on the launch site. They were intending to land it offshore. And then it essentially continued down on its ballistic arc. Meanwhile, Starship, its engines were all working. It made some, you know, attitude adjustments, but it basically continued moving towards orbit, picking up speed as, the booster began to pick up speed as it began to fall inexorably towards the ground. And I note there's a bunch of really cool angles here where you can actually see Boca Chica and everything down there. It's pretty much falling right alongside the launch plume. You know, if you look, you'll see that actually follows through the shadow and the sun is sort of eclipsed or occluded by the plume. The telemetry we're going to look at for the booster is in the bottom left here. You see the atmospheric drag is slowing it down, but it is still descending at, you know, basically twice the speed of sound. Now, at this point, we flip over to actually show the engines lighting up and watch those very carefully because you'll see they're going to relight 13 engines. They don't get all 13, and then a couple of those engines shut off. It is decelerating, but it is not decelerating quickly enough to bring itself to a complete halt above the surface. And eventually, it smashes into the surface, and we just get this final frame. Now, if you plot the altitude versus time, you can figure out that it's probably descending at about 100 miles an hour when it actually hits the surface. And it was decelerating fairly rapidly, so by my measure, like, they only needed to have started the burn a couple of hundred meters earlier, and they could have performed a soft, you know, deceleration above the ocean. But instead, they just, you know, splashed down hard, and no doubt the booster tanks would have ruptured instantly, and there was a blast of fire, I believe observed by NASA Spaceflight, who would have had cameras pointing at that. Meanwhile, Starship found itself free of engine problems, and it successfully reached orbit just after 8 minutes and began its traditional propellant dumps and everything, you know, to relieve pressure, dump stuff, I don't know. It does all this gas stuff, and we've got used to watching these things shoot out. Of course, some of this gas stuff is just like safing the engines or whatever, reducing pressure. Others, it uses the same ullage gases for attitude control. And the first big maneuver it makes in terms of its attitude control is to turn itself to Starlink deployment orientation. So there were 20 satellites on board, and these are not like the Dumblings, they're not like the Dodger Dogs. These were actual, honest to God, Starlink V3, which were, of course, too big to fly on Falcon 9. But for this flight, they were going to launch these things, fully, you know, test them in a small amount of time, because these things would be following Starship on this suborbital trajectory, right? Their life was going to be limited, so they were going to launch and pretty much run straight into a test sequence. Some of them were going to be equipped with extra capable cameras that would be able to take pictures of the heat shield. I believe a number of them had lights that they would be able to illuminate the heat shield, because while this maneuvered into orientation relatively quickly, they didn't start deploying the satellites until after sunset. And moreover, the satellites that actually had the cameras and the lights, they were the last ones to be deployed. So they took several minutes to get through this deployment sequence. But yeah, you can see these are the first V3 Starlinks being deployed, albeit they are being deployed in an orbit which will lead to their certain doom. And I'm going to say it's probably a good thing these aren't the StarMind AI satellites, because, you know, when the AI takes over, I could totally see them treating this as a war crime against machine intelligence. So yeah, the deployment took well over 10 minutes. And then, you know, after we'd got to satellite number 16 or whatever, that's when we started to see the flashlights coming on. Since the spacecraft had been, you had orbited over to the dark side of the Earth, that's why the spacecraft needed to have, you know, lights on them so that they could illuminate the spacecraft. And the idea was that these would, you know, be able to take photographs off the heat shield after the launch process, but before the re-entry process. So they're giving them a glimpse of what the heat shield actually looked like before the re-entry happened. So after the cameras were deployed, the spacecraft performed what I would call a beauty roll, a pirouette in space, so that the cameras would be able to view all sides of the heat shield. So if you look in the bottom right, you can actually see the tiny model is rotating, but also in the top left, you can see these blue spots up there. And I believe those are Starlink satellites which have been deployed. And I'm wondering whether the blue color is because they're, you know, firing their ion thrusters, whether they are testing those on battery power, having deployed them. It would actually make sense for them to fire those things. But, you know, again, it's kind of cool seeing these things floating out in space for part of their brief life. So we get a picture of these things before they burn up in the atmosphere. Now, at this time, SpaceX haven't released any imagery from these cameras. Last time, they only released a very small segment, which, you know, sort of looked like the undocking footage. But I'm presuming that their engineers are looking at it, especially considering that they'll be able to do a full-on before and after comparison. So after the beauty roll was complete, it was time for the engine test. Again, this is the most important thing that we wanted to see on this. We wanted a clean engine test in orbit since they didn't see that on the previous flight. Now you can see these cool like patterns in the background. They're basically blowing gas through the engine to chill it down, and it's interacting with the tenuous upper atmosphere. But just wait, when the engine actually lights up, it's gonna look radically different. So there we go. Right, that is the engine firing and interacting with the atmosphere. It just looks absolutely surreal. Again, you're 140 kilometers up. This is essentially a vacuum as far as the human body is concerned, but there is enough gas up there that it interacts with the plume coming out. And, you know, that gas that's coming out is very hot, but it's actually slamming into the Earth's atmosphere at an even higher velocity than the exit velocity from the gas. So it gets brighter and hotter, and that's what we see from the surface. And the best part, this is so bright that it was actually visible from the ground to a number of observers in South Africa. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before. It looks like it was actually firing its engine sideways, but again, you know, you can see this forms like a cometary-like structure as it's plowing through, again, 150 kilometers up, almost no atmosphere. But when you spread out enough, it still impinges, it compresses, and it creates this light. And that was a fabulous show. So again, demonstrating engine relight is probably the most important thing that they've done on this flight, because they need to be able to be sure that they can reliably bring a spacecraft home. And again, bring it home on target. That's where they're going to have to actually fire the engines at the right time so that they can begin the re-entry process in a position where they have enough cross-range steering capability to put it exactly where it needs to be so that it can actually get caught. Now, I imagine that there will also be like contingency plans where they just bring it down in the middle of the ocean if they somehow don't have that level of finesse. For this flight, even if they hadn't made the engine burn, they would be coming down and re-entering over the Indian Ocean. And I've been skipping over this because, once again, it was live spectacular views of what re-entry looks like from Starship, delivered in Technicolor glory. And this time we had another soundtrack by Test Shot Starfish, who were debuting a number of their new tunes, and some of them fit in perfectly. I will no doubt be checking that out, perhaps doing some edits or whatever. But yeah, the entry was absolutely benign. It was exactly what we wanted it to be, right? Nice and chill, or at least hot, or perfect. There was, of course, the turn maneuver that they performed. This is where they basically bank the spacecraft hard and they curve the entire trajectory around. Now, they have to do this at relatively low speed because, of course, your turn gets tighter the slower you are. At this point, it transitions into the regular belly flop, making small orientation changes as it's chasing after its imaginary tower, which is placed in the middle of the Indian Ocean. All the camera angles seem to show a Starship in relatively good condition. No serious big chunks of missing tiles or anything. We get down to the landing attitude, and that's when it gets extremely exciting, of course. There's barely any clouds, and as it descends through about 1 kilometer, that's when the transition from the belly flop to the ass-first landing occurs. All three sea-level Raptors light up, and it transitions to a vertical attitude. You watch it come down, and of course, there is a drone on hand watching it come down. And we've seen this happen a few times before. We watch it start to keel over. We wait for the big kaboom. And there is no kaboom. I mean, we've always expected that Starship will explode when it landed on the water because it's something the size of an office building, and when it falls over, it tends to break up because it doesn't have, you know, structural strength in those directions. The fact that this falls over and doesn't it go up in a giant kaboom is very, very special. I mean, sure, it's kind of cool to punctuate the end of the mission with a giant fireball. At least we get a bit of fire here as it is dumping excess propellant. But seeing this thing sitting in the ocean is surreal. But also it's a massive bonus to the people who are, of course, trying to investigate the heat shield and design the heat shield, because it fell over on its back. The belly is perfectly exposed to the sky. I'm sure they've lost a few tiles around the base, but by sheer luck, they hit the water in the right way. The waves came up in the right way. There was just enough, like, foam or whatever. I don't know what it was, but the, you know, it, as it fell over, it was cushioned enough that we got to see this thing. We've seen these white streaks on the heat shield previously, but now we can see that most of them actually begin at tile boundaries, and they begin on the leading edge of the tile boundaries, which leads me to believe that it's the result of, you know, gas getting in underneath and lifting stuff out. This angle here on the fin shows that whatever it is washed off very easily by the water. And then we see cameras that are on Starship actually giving us imagery from underneath the water. So all the cameras just continued to work and somehow managed to get connectivity to the outside world. Like in space, I know they're using Starlink, but in this case, the Starlink antenna is pointing down into the ocean. So I'm wondering if there's some other connectivity with the buoys nearby. It's also apparently continued to broadcast its position, or at least its position is being updated using on the SpaceX servers, even after it's been sitting in the ocean for a couple of hours. So it's essentially like broadcasting positions somehow. So anyway, as you look over this, there's definitely a few cases where you can see a tile edge is broken, and the white sort of trail that goes downwind from is much bigger when you see a very obvious crack. I don't know if, you know, we get the resolution to actually definitively associate each of these streaks with tile damage. And the question then is, you know, will these tiles need replaced, or could they just fly again? Also, yeah, we got the look from the inside. The Raptor is in good condition. I don't see any, like, smashed nozzles or anything there. So now, with the successful relight and the landing, we were wondering whether they would be attempting to recover the Starship on the next flight, and Elon Musk has officially said that unless we discover problems after mission data review, SpaceX will attempt to catch the ship with the tower on the next flight. They haven't said anything about the booster because clearly that has its own problems to be dealt with. The other big question we have is, what's going to happen to this? Because I would love to see this brought back to shore and turned into a monument, given a parade even. Yeah, by the way, you can see some of the damaged tiles in this angle. They're much more obvious once we get up this close. Yeah, they are about 1,000 kilometers offshore, and they could possibly tow this in. Now, there might be issues with ITAR because they would take it to Australia, and Australia is obviously not the USA. Australia might not want to have space junk get towed onto their coastline. After all, Australia has a history of space junk, right? I hope these legal issues can get sorted out and this thing can get towed back as far as it can, because again, it would be a pretty sweet thing to put on, you know, show off somewhere or other. Meanwhile, I fully expect that the SpaceX engineers looking at the heat shield are already comparing the damage seen here with whatever they saw on orbit from the satellites. They will no doubt have a lot of work ahead of them, given that we're expecting flight 14 next month. I'm Scott Manley. Fly safe.